The Defense Department will test its new F-35 Joint Strike Fighter against an aging A-10 Warthog, but not until 2018. The Pentagon says it wants to see whether both jets can perform high-threat close air support. Air Force Chief of Staff General Mark Welsh calls the testing a silly exercise. Richard Abulafia is Vice President for Analysis at the Teal Group Corporation and an analyst in the aircraft industry. Richard, it's great to talk to you as always. What is the significance of this, given that it won't take place until 2018? Is it really such a big deal? Thanks for coming on today, Richard.
It's a pleasure to be here, Francis. And, you know, I'm not so sure I see a huge level of significance here. You're going to continue the standoff that you've seen for some years now, which is that the Air Force would like to retire the A-10, and other people, particularly in Congress, but very few other places, want to keep it going. And, of course, both sides are going to marshal all of the arguments they can in favor of their positions. And this is just another exercise that's designed to support those arguments.
You mentioned that there are very few people outside of Congress that want to continue the A-10. Who are those people and where do they live, Richard? Where in the landscape of the aerospace business do they live?
Well, there's a couple of folks, a couple of groups of folks, one of which is completely noble and the other perhaps more just selfish. You know, on the selfish side, obviously, there are people who work on the A-10, and whether it's in depots or the various companies that upgrade and support the product. And, you know, they want to keep that business going. And most of the time, the people in Congress who want to keep it going have an interest in positioning the aircraft in their state or supporting the aircraft in their state. The more noble side of it is that there really are special operators out there, counterinsurgency folks in the military who do appreciate what it brings to the table in very specific and certain circumstances, and they want to keep it in because it does provide a fairly unique and highly specialized form of air support.
It strikes me that if anything, the announcement of this testing will only stretch this debate out maybe for longer than it might have lasted otherwise because of the 3-year window that we have now. We know for a fact that the A-10 will exist at least for the next 3 years to execute these tests.
That's kind of ironic. I mean, that's exactly right. It does stretch things out. In many ways, it could be a tacit acknowledgement that there's no hope of retiring this jet in the short-term time horizon.
So is that a win, then, for the advocates of the program, both noble and more selfish, that you just laid out?
Quite possibly. You know, I mean, it was always unclear as to what extent the Air Force was overstating the cost footprint of having some of these aircraft around. They're probably correct. They could use the money elsewhere. Absolutely. But on the other hand, we're talking about a relatively small time horizon. Even when the A-10 supporters go on about how important it is to keep this jet, these are aircraft built in the 80s. And the idea that they're going to soldier on as some sort of relevant tactical combat aircraft beyond 2025 is just really not all that thinkable.
Speaking of unclear, I think one could argue that the Air Force has been a little unclear about the purpose of the F-35. I note a report from Defense News where the Chief of Staff of the Air Force, General Mark Welsh, this report says, noted the Air Force never intended to use the multi-role fighter jet, the F-35, as a direct replacement for the A-10. Yet when I follow the Project on Government Oversight's link to the F-35 program's website, jsf.mil, and click on the background link there. This is a quote from the website. The F-35 is designed to replace aging fighter inventories, including U.S. Air Force A-10s and F-16s. So there's a confusion, it seems, that's not helping the Air Force make its case. Is that a fair observation on my part, do you think?
Yeah, I think it's a very fair observation. They haven't been clear, and there's basically, you know, it depends what you mean the word replacement, I suppose you could say. If you're talking about a direct replacement, you know, really nothing can replace a very dedicated, low-level, heavily armed, heavily armored ground attack aircraft. I mean, you'd want to build another A-10 in order to do that. Now, the other word uses, can some of the missions and roles be played by a tactical fighter that also did double duty as a strike aircraft? The answer is absolutely. So direct replacement, no. Indirect replacement, yes. And I think it sort of gets into the broader debate as to how the nation wants its military to be configured. If the future of the U.S. is more Iraqs and Afghanistans, hey, the A-10 is essential. if the future of the U.S. is returning to history, acting like a superpower, standing up to Russia, standing up to China, pivoting to Asia, then the A-10 is comprehensively useless and just a budget drain. So in other words, when we talk about A-10 versus JSF, there's so much more that we should be debating as a nation. And sometimes there's real confusion. I remember when the Crimea trouble started, John McCain proposed sending hundreds of A-10s to Europe, in which case, if there really was a confrontation, those A-10s would last 6 seconds. I mean, this is not a survivable combat aircraft for direct confrontations with a near-peer adversary. However, it is extremely useful if you are dealing with guerrillas who are lightly armed in the middle of the desert.
Richard Abulafia, Vice President for Analysis at the Thiel Group Corporation and an expert on the aerospace industry. We're learning about some issues with the KC-46 aircraft that is another multiple role aircraft in the Air Force. What do we know about the issues that the KC-46 is having, Richard, and how is that impacting mission potentially for the Air Force?
Well, it's a complicated series of events that led us here, but probably the most important fact is that Boeing signed up for an extremely difficult contract when it took this. And the reason it had to do that is because there was a lot of competitive pressure from Airbus. So they agreed to do a deal in which they met a very rigorous timetable, and they agreed to meet the majority of cost overruns out of their own pocket, something they're now doing. So we're talking $1 billion-plus out of their own pocket to pay for these overruns. There have been a couple of real technical snafus and mishaps lately with the development of the initial prototypes. There have been delays to first flights of the conforming aircraft. And the belief that they still maintain that there's a pretty good chance they can get 18 aircraft up and running by, I believe, mid-2017, as the contract stipulates. There's a lot of doubt about that at this point. So the bad news is serious troubles, lots of money. The good news is it's mostly Boeing's nickel beyond a certain amount, a very small amount, I believe about $400 million. The other billion or more comes out of Boeing's pocket, not the taxpayer. The issue as to whether or not it affects U.S. military readiness, probably not, because, you know, you're really talking about a small number. The KCX has been delayed for well over a decade now, and the U.S. has 400-plus other tankers that are doing the job. So whether or not we have 18 in service in 2017, that perhaps isn't all that material. As long as we do get going with the program, as long as there is a way out of this that gives us a useful aircraft, and we can get 179 more or less in the stipulated period.
We just have a minute or so left, but I wonder if a contract like that isn't a case of fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me. The likelihood that Boeing or anybody else would do a contract like that again after seeing what happens with the KC-46 is probably not very great.
Yeah, it's a good point. The whole issue of what kind of burden share that contractors sign up for is hugely contentious. This is in a lot of ways a worst case scenario because of the highly politicized environment. You know, you had Airbus versus Boeing, the threat of a European competitor getting his foot on U.S. soil. As well as the fact that the Boeing team was more or less aligned with the Democrats and the Airbus team more aligned with the Republicans, all of this led Boeing to a place where they had to sign up to anything. Having said that, you're right, and there's a lot of burden on the bomber contract, the upcoming LRSB contract, that's being put on the contractors that allows them or causes them to absorb a great deal of risk. So it is an interesting debate.
Excellent insight. Look forward to your analysis as these contracts play out. Richard, thanks for your time today.